The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
Then you get into something else I wanted to talk to you about, and that's the power equation. I always think this, that we are up against that. You know, if you take away the structure, you take away maybe the control of power, and people who are in these positions are people who adore power. Are we not up against that?
Yes, 100%. That is exactly why it's so difficult. But that's exactly why we have to be honest about that and confront that and understand that that's the only way that anything's going to change.
Power, politics, change. Just when you think it's impossible, along comes a Donald Trump, now the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party's bid for the presidency, and politics as we know it has been turned on its head. Today on the Helicaster Jane Show, two men who have a lot to say about American politics and the Trump candidacy. Up first, Steve Hilton, former senior advisor to Prime Minister David Cameron, and now out with a new book, More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First. And Tom Nichols, senior contributor to The Federalist, and by the way, a five-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. We'll be back with my guests in a minute, but first, welcome. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. The Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And while you're there, explore our ads and support the show with a click on the links. We want to welcome our new partner, our favorite store, the finest in offering gourmet foods, Dean and DeLuca. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, SoundCloud, the iHeart Radio Network, and at our newest home on Google Play Music. Steve Hilton has been called many things. One, the Steve Jobs of politics. Hilton, the t-shirt clad guy, is one of the UK's most known political figures, probably only behind David Cameron and Boris Johnson. As Prime Minister Cameron's senior advisor, he literally remade the Tory party into a modern, winning, conservative party after decades in exile. Now Hilton has his eyes set on America's political system. He is out with a brand new book, More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First. He says that government, business, the lives we lead, the food we eat, the way our children are brought up, the way we relate to the natural world around us, it's all become too big and distant and industrialized. Inhuman. It's time to do something about it. It's time to put people first. It's time to make the world more human. Hilton is also the co-founder and CEO of CrowdPack, a Silicon Valley political, nonpartisan tech startup, and teaches at Stanford University. Let's talk. All right, okay. Steve, it's the morning after. How exciting is this, old Mr. Political Guru? Surely you have some comments on Mr. Trump's win, extraordinary win. Talk to me.
I think it's really exciting because it shows that one of the main arguments I've been making and write about in my book, More Human, is that for many, many years now, for decades, the systems and the structures that we've built to run the modern world have just become taken over by a kind of technocratic agenda run by bankers and bureaucrats and accountants that have been pushing globalization and technological change at any cost and favoring big business over small business and prioritizing efficiency over everything else and forgetting the impact of all that on real people, on real working people in their lives. And you're seeing what the Trump success shows is that people are sick of all of that and they're really in revolt against all of that. Now, that is not to say that I necessarily agree with everything he's saying or all his positions, But I'm thrilled that what he's done is shine a spotlight on the way the world has been going and the big changes I think we need to make the world more human.
I have to ask you this. How come the party missed it? How come the press missed it? Everybody missed how angry people were. What's your take on that?
I think that it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but I think it's because they genuinely are out of touch. They live different lives to the people who are, you know, who are suffering, have been suffering the consequences of the agenda that they have been united behind. And when I say united behind, what I mean is that actually it has made very little difference whether Republicans have been in charge or Democrats have been in charge. You've had the same kind of agenda promoted about, and also in the private sector, in the way that companies behave. And it's made really very little difference to people who's been in charge. And that's why they've been so angry, because it seems as if it doesn't matter who you vote for, doesn't matter what you do, we get the same old stuff. And basically the elites just keep telling us we have to suck it up. This is the modern world. Just got to go with it. And they've had enough. And I think that the reason that everyone missed it was because the people that you're describing have not had to suffer those realities. They are literally living in a different world. And that's why they just didn't understand the depth of anger that I think has been there for many, many years.
It's fascinating. Now, listen, about this book, More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First. Well, now there's a novel idea, Steve. People come first. I mean, talk to me. How come you're the one who finally put the finger on the pulse of what needs to be changing here?
Well, I don't know about finally. I mean, this is what I write about in my book is very much what I've been arguing in politics and policy terms for many, many years now, including back in the UK. I live out in California now, and I've been there for 4 years, but prior to that I was in the British government working for Prime Minister David Cameron, and the agenda that we were trying to advance there was very much about some of the things I talk about in More Human, in terms of trying to dismantle some of these structures that have put decisions further and further away from people, so they have this sense that the things that affect their lives are decided by distant bureaucrats or CEOs or whatever who don't understand their lives. In government in the UK, we did try to change some of that and put power back into people's hands by, for example, giving people control over zoning decisions in their neighborhood, or trying to dismantle some of the centralization that affected the British government. You know, in various ways, we tried to do this, but I wouldn't say at all that we did a perfect job. In fact, I was very frustrated at the fact that we didn't achieve many of the things I wanted to do. And that's, in a sense, why I wanted to write this book, to say, well, look, if I had a free hand, if I could design the perfect world, the perfect way we would run schools and healthcare, the way we would get our food, the way we would run government, what would that look like? And that's the picture I've tried to paint in this book, More Human. It's a kind of ideal version of a world where people really are in control of the things that matter to them.
I have to ask you this, these enormous structures that are built within government and in the food industry, and you take everybody on in this wonderful book of yours, but was it sinister, or was it just, it was the time and that looked like the answer, or what? I mean, is it sinister? Was it sinister? Which would make it tougher to deconstruct?
No, I don't think it's that. I don't think that the people involved have bad intentions. And I'm really at pains to say that in the book, that the people that I encountered working in government, the senior civil servants and people in business, I think they all think they're doing the right thing. They all mean well most of the time, and they're highly professional and smart, decent people. And in a sense, I make this point in the introduction. It's the fact that over the years, the systems themselves have become so big and bureaucratic. They actually make people behave in ways that wouldn't behave if they were just able to be human. One of the story that I tell at the beginning of the very first story in the book, the very personal human story about a mother traveling on JetBlue with her two children, who ends up being treated in an appalling fashion by the flight attendant on a JetBlue flight. And if you take a step back from the story there, you would say to yourself, nobody would treat a mother with her child like that in normal life. That flight attendant wasn't a sinister or ill-intentioned person. It's just that the systems that have grown up, the airline policies, the Federal Aviation guidelines and all this kind of stuff, all these layers and layers of bureaucracy, they end up forcing people to behave in inhuman ways. And I think that is true right across the board in government and the economy. And that is the fundamental reason I think people are so frustrated and angry. And so the real answer, I think, is not just to change the face at the top or change a few policies here and there. It is actually to really dismantle these structures that have built up over decades and make things work on a more human level.
You know, when you're telling the story about JetBlue, and you could do that with calling Comcast or calling any of these corporations
exactly,
to get help.
Exactly.
And it's as if people don't think anymore. There's no thinking. There's just, here's the A, B, C, D list I'm supposed to follow.
I totally agree. Exactly. It is literally in you. And I find myself all the time, I'm sure many people listening would the same, was like, why can't you just talk to me like a human being? Why can't you just stop being this robot? And of course, it's not their fault. They're told to do that. They're not bad people. When they leave their jobs, they're regular, lovely, charming people like everyone. But when they get in these positions, they have to follow these rules and these structures and that's what drives everyone crazy, including the people doing it, I think. They don't want to have to behave like that. They don't like the fact that they have to treat people so badly.
You're kinder than I. You're kinder than I. But listen to me about this. If you were to deconstruct these huge bureaucratic structures, if you will, that have been put into place, then you get into something else I wanted to talk to you about, and that's the power equation. You know, I always think this, that we are up against that. You know, if you take away the structure, you take away maybe the control of power, and people who are in these positions are people who adore power. Are we not up against that?
Yes, 100%. That is exactly why it's so difficult. But that's exactly why we have to be honest about that and confront that and understand that that's the only way that anything's going to change. So let's get specific about it. In terms of the corporations in the private sector, it really does mean breaking up these giant corporations that have emerged. Because what you're seeing in America today is in almost every sector a massive concentration of economic power. That is very un-American. It is not in keeping with the spirit of American capitalism and free enterprise, which is all about fair competition. And we don't have that anymore in nearly every sector. And so that we have to have a massively more aggressive and tough antitrust policy. And it starts by breaking up these companies, not just the banks that we hear about the whole time, but the airlines and the telecom companies and the health insurance companies and the giant food and agriculture businesses. The reason that they can become so dehumanized is precisely as you just said, they can abuse their power. And in the end, the term I use in More Human to describe these companies is that they're barely businesses at all. They're really private sector bureaucracies. They're practically like an arm of the government in the sense that the way that they operate and the way they see their success is not necessarily just competing in the marketplace, but actually using lawyers and lobbyists to influence the rules to their advantage, to keep competitors out and to entrench their power. And so there's only one way to deal with that, is literally to break them up. And then to have much tougher rules to stop them accumulating so much power in the marketplace that they can abuse it. Mm-hmm. And so we got to do that right across the board. It's really, really hard because they have captured the levers of power in Washington, D.C. They have got their teeth into all the legislators. This is why Trump, going back to your earlier question, this is why he has a real appeal, because he called that out. He says that's what's going on, as he puts it. Why is healthcare such a disaster? Because the big insurance companies take care of, in his words, the legislature. That's true.
Oh, yes, it is. And that brings to mind two thoughts. Let's talk money first, because money is one of the big issues here. There's so much money in the politics and the lobbyists, and, you know, they've just completely screwed up the game for the little guy. How do you get that fixed?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. It brings me to my day job, really, which is running this business called CrowdPack out in California. It's a tech startup focused on politics, and specifically it's a crowdfunding site for politics. And the reason that I started it was that I, looking at this terrible problem of big money in politics, and remember, it's not just from big businesses, it's just as much a problem on the other side with the way that the unions, the public sector unions in particular, completely control policy on the left, and that doesn't operate in the public interest either. for example, it stops the kind of innovation you want to see in the way schools are run and provided. So it's a cross-party problem, the money in politics. Now, the reason that when I took a look at what was going on, it seems to me that you've got all these different people and organizations campaigning for change, for getting money out of politics or changing the rules. And it seems to me that it's very hard to see how any of them are going to be successful because there's no consensus around a solution. So what I thought we might usefully do is actually try and approach it a different way and achieve change through the marketplace. And so I started this company CrowdPack as a crowdfunding site for politics. So the idea is that we can make it much easier for citizens to find and fund candidates that support, that kind of match their beliefs, and try and, in a sense, dilute the power of the big money, bring more small donors in, do for every race, not just the presidential race, a little bit like what Bernie Sanders has been doing, get more small donors in, and thereby make the, like, dilute the influence and the power of the big donors. That's the idea behind CrowdPack. And so that's my way of trying to do something about it.
I love CrowdPack, and I love the concept of the people then get to do what they want to do and get control over it. And they could. I mean, Bernie Sanders, and I guess Barack Obama even proved it, that, you know.
That's exactly right, yeah.
The truth
is that that's one race out of, you know, whatever, 400,000 that go on in America. And so if you really look at the corrupting power of money in politics, it's actually not at the presidential level. It's lower than that. It's certainly Congress, but even in a way, even more so state legislation.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you actually look at the policy decisions that really affect people's lives on a daily basis, a huge chunk of them happen at the state legislative level, and there's very little scrutiny of what goes on there. You've got local media closing down. People don't know their state representative. They don't follow what goes on. And it's just and it's literally been just completely bought by big money interests on the left and the right.
Right. Yeah, I'd love to go there with you, and I will for a second, because I actually bring this up in the second interview that's on the show today. And I say that there is no local anymore in America. That's a problem. We don't have local newspapers that are telling people what's going on. We don't have local stations. Radio stations now are, you know, owned by Clear Channel and the big people, and so they're running, you know, national shows rather than what's happening on the local level. I do think that has a lot to do with a lot of the problems that are going on.
Yes.
You know,
I really agree with that.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely right.
And that's something that has to be fixed. The other thing that I wanted to get to you with is, okay, so we're going to do this, and I love your concept, and I'm with you all the way on this, but then you're up against this. What do you do with these CEOs? What, off with their heads? I mean, they're not going to give up their structure, so what are we going to do?
No, they're going to fight, but you've got to, you know, I remember being around in the UK when Margaret Thatcher started taking on she's famous for taking on the entrenched power of the union bosses, and that was a big fight that was very brutal, but she had to win. But also there was the CEOs then. It's very interesting. People don't remember this, but there's an organization called the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, and it represented all the establishment CEOs in the UK, and they were absolutely hostile to what Mrs. Thatcher was doing to reform the British economy, because she was taking on their power as well. And she was a Conservative Prime Minister. In fact, I remember there's a famous phrase that the head of the CEO's organization, the CBI, said that they would have a bare-knuckle fight with Mrs. Thatcher over her reforms to the British economy. And in the end, they had the fight, and she won. And honestly, there is no substitute for incredibly strong political leadership to take on and win these battles. That's the only way anything ever happens. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do with this book is set the table for that and set out an agenda for change that hopefully political leaders will take up and then battle for, and I hope to play my own part in that somehow in the years ahead.
I have to ask you this, Steve. You've been around this business for business, and I call it, now it's a business. Politics has become a business, and it used to be that the people who, you know, ran for office, were not business politicians. They were people who cared. Do you feel that the same people are manning the ship or going for the office today, or do we have a different kind of person running, a more narcissistic?
It's a really great question, and I think that is a big part of the problem, because people now are running for office who are very comfortable with the system and they know how to play the game and they are part of the system. And so there's a lot of evidence now that you have, you know, former, you know, people who worked in Congress as aides then run for Congress themselves, and they're very familiar. They're kind of recycling the same old people within the system, system-based people. And I think that's a really big problem. And that's why one of the other aspects of CrowdPAC that I really care about and hope will have an impact is the way that we want to make it easier for independent and independent-minded candidates to run for office. Because you have a lot of people who feel that they can make a contribution, that they don't like the way things are going in their community or at the state level or even at the national level. They want to run for office, but they think, you know what, I'm not a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not independently wealthy like Trump or Bloomberg. I can't get involved in politics because you've got to raise money. And to raise money, if you're a Republican, you have to go along with all the business stuff. And if you're a Democrat, you have to go along with the union stuff. And I don't really agree with that. I'm not going to bother. And what we've built at CrowdPAC is a very simple tool for anyone to run for office just by, literally, it's like crowdfunding, like a Kickstarter campaign where you can say, I'm interested in running for city council or state legislature, whatever it may be. And you can create a pledge campaign, which you can send out to your friends and your network of people and say, look, I'm thinking of running. Would you support me? And people can pledge money to you, and their card will only be charged if you actually enter the race. So it's a great way of people taking that first step into politics. And before going through all the hassle of setting up a fundraising committee and all the compliance stuff that's around that, they can quickly test the waters and get that confidence to know that there is support for them out there. And we're already seeing at the local level people who never would have thought of getting into politics actually running for office and winning. You know, we just had a great, in Pennsylvania at the State House, we had a candidate who complete outsider was nominated by, I think as a teacher, nominated by his students to run for office and actually ended up winning just now, the other week, and funded his campaign on CrowdPAC. So that is a small step forward and a small sign. But as we grow, I hope that one of the things that we'll be able to achieve through CrowdPAC is opening up the system so you get fresh faces into politics who are not captured by the same old big party machine.
You're so innovative. This is why I love you, why I wanted to talk to you. I've watched your career. I've watched what you've done. You're the exception to the rule, my friend. And to break through the noise with innovation these days is very tough. People like the tried and the true. The same thing with Donald Trump. I mean, they got to tear him down. Now, whether we agree with him and his tactics, even that's a different issue. But if you look at somebody like Trump, who is somewhat innovative, right, in his thinking, you see how the system responds. It goes into chaos. That's what we're up against. So even if you take your deconstructing the big monolithic, ridiculous size corporations. Chaos. Will chaos reign? Does chaos reign when we let go of the tried and the true and we go for the more innovative concepts?
I don't think it's chaos. I think that it's just, I think people, you know, in the end, I think you've got to have I have a view that people are very smart and sensible. And if you let them make more decisions, you get better outcomes. And I sort of trust people to do the right thing. And that sounds like a simplistic sort of cliche, but in the end, it's pretty fundamental. And that's been the genius of human progress forever, really, is that we've been able to figure things out and work together. And I guess in the end, that is a kind of maybe a particularly kind of conservative viewpoint, which is that this faith in human nature and this ability of people to do the right thing and organize through family and community and entrepreneurs starting businesses and so on, without some master plan from a distant administrator. That is definitely what I believe. And therefore, I think that if you break things up and give people control and power, good things will happen.
I like your thinking. But there is this too. They're making the outsiders, the Bernie Sanders, the Donald Trumps, into the boogeyman now. And that's what I'm. That's the response from the establishment.
But nobody's listening to that. That's what's really interesting. In this whole debate about that's happened the last few days, there's been a bit of a discussion around whether the media themselves created Donald Trump. and by giving him all this coverage and so on. Well, you know, the truth is that so much of the coverage has been negative, highlighting all the things that people don't like about what he says. And people just ignore it. They think, oh, we're sick of all of you. Here's someone who's different and may just change things. And I think that if you talk to Donald Trump supporters and the people voting for him, I would say that a lot of them aren't even, they wouldn't say for sure that they know he's going to do anything different, but they think at least he feels like he might. And we're certainly not going to get any change from these other people, so we might as well give him a chance. I think that's the attitude.
Well, I think that's the attitude of the people. I'm talking about the establishment. The establishment's coming down on him in every way possible that they can. Listen, I want to talk about the word soundbite. You know that word. That's a scary word. It's a scary word because it is the new member of political discourse. And in this day and age, can a politician live without that soundbite? Trump is the master of soundbite. And let me say this. Soundbites, to me, are synonymous with the simplistic one-size-fits-all solution that you are so railing against. We have a problem now with this, you know, and it's both sides of the aisle, by the way, on the simplistic answer to people. Talk to me.
I think that the problem has been that it goes back to your earlier point about the professionalization of politics. And I think that the thing that people are sick of are these slick phrases that they know, you can hear as they're spoken, that they've been crafted by experts to kind of make you agree with them and think that the person is saying what you want to hear. And that's, I think, I mean, to be honest, I think that is a sort of big contrast between, say, a candidate like Ted Cruz and Trump, is that Trump actually, he does speak in a very simple way and uses words and language that's very direct and very simple, but not simplistic. It's actually pretty, it's kind of the opposite. It's just, it's very authentic. It's not crafted. It's not kind of considered. It's just really simple and people can understand it first because it's simple, but also they get the feeling that it's authentic, that it's not actually the product of some sort of endless research process by marketing professionals. Whereas when you hear Cruz speak, I think that is the impression that people got. And that's where the soundbite culture, I think, is so damaging. People just hear this stuff and think, oh, I don't believe it. It's just the kind of stuff that's just been written for them. They don't really mean it.
I want to go back to one thing about this terrific book of yours, Inhuman. You make a very interesting point about Sandra throwing out education should be free. And you say that's actually against the concept that you're fomenting in this book. Talk to me about that before we go.
Well, I think that it's a fault. Well, here's a couple of things.
Okay.
First of all, we've got to understand that in terms of what government can spend on things, there has to be a limit, right? You in order to have a dynamic economy, you have to have a healthy balance between what the state takes from people and companies in the form of taxation and what it spends. And if you let that get out of whack, then it actually starts to hurt the economy and you get into debt and it harms job creation and job growth. And so you can't let there's a limit to what you can spend. So the next question is, how do you allocate those resources? How do you decide what the state, what government should spend money on? And I think that there's two things. First of all, there is, when you come to something, there's a sort of general point about higher education and college, which is that when you say that it should be free, as he is saying, in order to make that happen, you're actually going to end up giving money to families who are already paying for college and who could perfectly well afford to pay for college. And there's no problem. And the fees are not a barrier to those families going to college. You're actually, in other words, what you're really doing there is taking money from poor families and giving it to rich families, which I think is the opposite of the kind of fairness argument that Sanders is making. But there's a broader point here, which is that if you actually think about where do you get the best value for the money that government puts into things, I think that generally over the last many decades, actually, we've been getting the balance wrong because actually, all the evidence shows that in terms of the return on your investment, in terms of really helping transform people's lives and give them the best start in life, the most important period for education is not college, it's not high school, it's not even K through 12, it's actually before kids even get to school. It's the early years. It's the first few years of life. There's so much evidence now from neuroscience and other fields that the things that happen with children's brain development and character development when they're, you know, 1 year old, 2 year old, 3 year, before they even get to school, that's what really counts. And we really underinvest in that. And so what I argue for in More Human is a massive switch of emphasis. So actually, if we really care about giving every child the best start in life and the best chances through life, then we need to get much better support into families and children at an early age. And in fact, if anything, we should take government money away from college and put it into the early years, because that's where you're going to get a better return on investment.
Before I let you go, great guru that you are, Trump, Clinton, who wins?
It's so difficult, but I honestly would, you made me choose today, I would put my money on Trump, because I feel like there's a real desire for fundamental change, and he's the one that is offering that. Now, you may say, well, he's not really offering that. Where's the policy program? Where's the platform? It's just his character and so on. That's a fair criticism. But when you look at Hillary Clinton, that doesn't look like someone who represents change. And I think that's what people want. Now, having said that, there's a long few months of campaigning to go. And as we know, these are both tough competitors. And there's lots of mud to throw around on both sides. And who knows where all that will go. But I think that in terms of the mood of the country, feels like Trump is more in tune with that than Clinton right now.
Here's my answer to you, though you didn't ask, I'm going to give it. You want to know why I think Trump wins? The title of your book, More Human.
Right.
I've been speaking with Steve Hilton, author of More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First, by way of Public Affairs, a member of the Perseus Group. For your copy of the book, visit Amazon.com. You are listening to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. My guests today are Steve Hilton, author of More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First, and Tom Nichols, a senior contributor at TheFederalist.com. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Hi, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. Are you enjoying the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKasserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. Tom Nichols is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College and at the Harvard Extension School. He has written widely, including 5 books on international relations, Russian affairs, and nuclear weapons. In addition to his academic posts, he has been a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Carnegie Council on Ethics and International Relations, and the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. In Washington, he served as personal staff for defense and security affairs in the United States Senate to the late Senator John Hines of Pennsylvania. He is also a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. He is a senior contributor at The Federalist. His latest piece, If I Lose Friends Over Trump, So Be It, says that Donald Trump's candidacy isn't really about politics, which is why it divides people so deeply. It's about revenge? Let's talk.
I feel your pain, buddy. I was reading your piece, and I got to tell you, I was laughing, and I shouldn't laugh because I feel your pain. Really and truly, talk to me. How did we get here? What the hell is going on? Talk to me.
Well, I think that this is the end result of a process that's been going on for a long time in American life. It's about resentment. It's about envy. It's about responsibility. It's about the failure of public education, as far as I'm concerned. It's been a lot of confluences coming together, and this was a perfect storm. You have a TV star who happens to be sitting on $1 billion and doesn't have anything else to do, who barreled into a Republican primary, and there was a market waiting for him, and here we are.
Here we are. So you write this piece. Here's this piece. If I lose friends over Trump, so be it.
Oh my God! Why now? Why'd you write it now? What was circulating inside that little core of yours that was driving you insane that needed to get out?
Well, among a lot of my friends and colleagues and people on social media and places like The Federalist, we started talking about the fact that this was really dividing friendships and that Trump's supporters, in particular, were prone to some pretty vile expressions of their support for Trump and pretty un-American descriptions of their opponents, the traitors and other things that I won't repeat in the next company. And we asked ourselves, you know, why is this happening? We've certainly had unpopular presidential candidates before. I always mention that I'm old enough to remember people shouting at each other about Richard Nixon as a kid. But this is different. This is really the kind of thing that's, you know, threatening to break up friendships and relationships and even family relationships. And so I sat down to say, you know, what can we do about this? And my answer was, there isn't anything you can do about it. If someone's going to end a friendship with you because you object to Donald Trump, then you just have to take that. And that was my kind of statement of principle. And if someone wants to break a friendship with me because I won't countenance their support of a man who makes fun of the handicapped and talks the way he does about women, you know, I have a daughter. I mean, this matters to me. Then so be it. Then I guess I'll just have to do without their friendship.
You use the word revenge, and that explain that, what you meant by that.
Trump is the candidate of revenge. If you think about it, he doesn't have much of a political platform. He changes his mind on most things, especially things that are important to conservatives, within minutes, hours, days. He's pro-life, he's pro-choice, he's pro-tariff, he's pro-high taxation, he's against taxes. He almost is incapable of emitting a coherent thought, but he does have one consistent principle, which is that I'll get even with everybody you don't like in your life. And that's what people really hear when they listen to him. They say he's a fighter. What he really means is he's going to go after people and make people uncomfortable and punish people that his voters think have done them harm somehow or somehow undermined their lives. And it's pure social resentment. It's simply social anger embodied. I can't tell you how many people have sent me messages or email messages after they've read one of my pieces saying, you know, once Trump is in, people like you are out. We're going to get even with people like you. You're out of here. And a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my friends who are conservative writers have gotten the same kinds of emails and messages. And there is almost this kind of status envy or social resentment. And if you think about it, when Trump gets up there, that's what pours out of him. These people, they, them, it's never we, us. No one ever takes responsibility. It's Trump thundering about those guys, those other people. When there's a protester, get them out of here. Get him out of here. He really is very adept at dividing people into us and them. And so, that speaks to a lot of people.
Let me read something you did write in this piece. Quote, Trump supporters are now like roaring drunks in a bar fight. People who you might have tried to reason with five drinks earlier, but now are just lashing out at everyone in every direction. Pumped up on talk radio conspiracies. Overdosing on the venom of Sean Hannity and Judge Jeanine. Comatose with irrational fury. They are no longer part of any sensible political debate in America. Could you say that this is not just about Trump, but it's also about the people who are enamored with him?
And, well, that's what I mean by there was a market waiting for him. I mean, there are millions of Americans who, you know, I have to say that I'm tired of saying it's justified anger because I'm not sure that it is anymore. There are people who have suffered because of globalization and economic change, things that were unavoidable that no president or Congress could do anything about, but also people that have just made bad life choices. There are people out there that have just made some really bad turns in their life and they want somebody to blame. And you can't reason with these people. You start off by saying, and I've done this, I've said, what is it that you think Trump will do? And the answers always devolve into he's going to kick out the Mexicans or he's going to kick out the Muslims or he's going to take money away from the something that's always kind of a getting even with somebody else. And at some point, you just throw up your hands and say, you can't have this discussion. It is like the buddy that you walked into the bar with 2 hours earlier that you were having a friendly conversation with. And, you know, eight tequilas later, you just can't talk to the guy. And I think that's where we are with these people.
But there's also this, the response to him from conservatives, some conservatives, the vitriol, the whatever you want to frame it in. Is there a lack of empathy for some people whose lives really
aren't going well. It's not just all bad mistakes. You mentioned that. You mentioned some others. Maybe, and in answer to Trump, the answer isn't in fighting back at Trump, but in figuring out what's going on in society that allows a Trump to rise to the top.
I reject that argument because I've tried to have that conversation. But, you know, when New Hampshire, where Trump won big, when Lily White, New Hampshire, with 4%, 3.5%, 4% unemployment, votes for Donald Trump because their biggest complaint is immigration, something's wrong. That's just scapegoating at that point. And I think this notion that, well, this is justifiable pain, it's infuriating because Donald Trump is somebody who, in any normal year, most of those people who are suffering that pain, they would identify Donald Trump as part of the problem. Trump is the system. He is the establishment. This is a billionaire who bends laws, makes deals with the mob, hires illegal aliens, all things that haven't really been discussed very much, but certainly will be as the general election approaches. And yet the very people that would be most hurt by a guy like Donald Trump are lining up to vote for him. And why? Because they saw him on TV, because he gets them pumped up, because he goes to New Hampshire and says he's going to save them all from Mexicans and Muslims. This is not an informed vote by people who are genuinely hurting. This is just rage by people who, in my opinion, just listen to too damn much talk radio.
Okay, but let's throw this out. I'm playing devil's advocate with you because I think the argument, you know, is a fun argument and it's a way to get to some core solutions, maybe, if you will. But let's go here. What if with Trump, okay, you're saying that it's, there's not one thing. Maybe there are a lot of things that are going on in people's lives, but the core here is they're rejecting the old establishment conservatism / GOP. We know that that's who they're rejecting. Whether they're right, wrong, and indifferent, that's what they're saying. So you just brush that off as they're wrong? Or do you say, you know, we need to find answers for these people. We need to offer them something other than Trump.
Well, a couple of things occur to me. First of all, these people had 17 choices at the beginning of this process. As I wrote in an earlier piece, if you couldn't find one person that you liked better than Donald Trump, in a field of 17 people, including people who have never held elective office before, then it's you. Then it's because you didn't want to. It's because you wanted to get on board with that Trump rage machine, and you didn't really want to look for alternatives. The other thing I would point out is that the same people who are shaking their fist at the system, this is a country where Americans reelect their own members of Congress at 95% reelection rates. This is the classic case of I hate everybody in the system except my guy. And that's another reason I don't take these too seriously. It's not like we've had some, you know, huge wave where 30 or 40 or 50% of Congress got turned over. Americans of both parties, and this goes for the Bernie supporters as well, Americans of both parties historically reelect their members of Congress at 95% reelection rates. So what answer can the Republican Party give when 38 to 40% of their primary electorate says our solution to this is a guy who is a lifelong liberal, who's only been a Republican very recently, whose views are nowhere close to conservative on almost anything except Mexicans and Muslims? There's simply no answer that any party can give to that. And so I don't take those views very seriously. And I'll add one more thing, Hallie.
Go ahead.
This bothers me because when people say, you know, things are going wrong, so this all goes right up to the office of the president. People say that as though there are no mayors or city councils or governors or state legislatures. I noticed this when I went to a Pat Buchanan rally in the 90s when I lived up in New Hampshire. I used to teach Dartmouth College. And a guy stood up and he said, look, if you're running for president, here's my question. What are you going to do to help me get a job here in Nashua? And the first thing I thought was, it's not the president's job to provide a job for everybody in Nashua, New Hampshire. That's not what presidents do. But Trump has enshrined that idea among a certain group of voters that it's the president's job to make your life worth living and to give you a job that you're going to like. And I think that is the ultimate expression of the liberal nanny state. And I think it's totally incompatible with the Republican Party and the conservative movement.
There's something that's interesting here, too, though. Something has changed in all of this, and I think it's worth mentioning. There are no local papers anymore. There is no local news anymore. And there's no small town anymore. There's no interaction anymore. I think that that has a lot to do with where we are today. Everything is on the big screen, you know, your big TV. And it's all politics all the time on your Fox and your CNN and your this. And it's all national.
Yes.
What happened to the small town politics? I think it's basically gone.
Well, my mom, and I should say, you know, people are always accusing me of being an elitist. I mean, my mom dropped out of high school after ninth grade and ended up running her own business and getting elected to our town council. So I definitely feel what you're saying here, because if you choose to get involved, at least back 20, 30 years ago when my mom did this in small town politics, you can get involved. And the problem, as you say, is people are sitting at home and they're watching Fox. And instead of voting, and I shouldn't just say Fox, CNN, MSNBC.
Well, I said all three because I think it is all they've now become the voice of America.
Well, I think everybody's emulated their model.
Right.
And you watch, you know, some of these talk programs and they say, what do you think about this? Send me a tweet at hashtag so-and-so. To which every time that goes up there, I think, who cares what you think about this? I mean, not the commentator, but who cares what the average person tweets behind a hashtag? But that's the new narcissism in America, that people think that their small town and their local city council, that's too boring to get involved with.
Right.
They want to go right to being on national television and having their say. Well, if that's what happens, then you can't complain when your roads don't get paved and the potholes aren't filled and your local businesses are zoned out of existence. All of that happens at the local level.
Well, and let me bring this one into you as well. Let me say to you, conservative talk radio, which is national, that's all that's playing on local stations. So all you're hearing is the federal argument. You're not hearing the small town argument. You're hearing Rush Limbaugh, who's not talking about what's going on, you know, in small town America. I think that that's part of the problem as well.
There's no doubt that, you know, and this pains me to say as a conservative, because back in the 90s, I listened to talk radio because it really was the only alternative to what I considered to be a monolithically liberal mainstream media. But talk radio has become toxic. There is no doubt about it. Talk radio, and let's be honest about something else, talk radio made Donald Trump. Had Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and all the others early on said, look, this guy is not a conservative. He's not really a contender for the conservative movement. He's not somebody we can live with. This probably would have flamed out a lot earlier, but it didn't. And so I'm as much as I wish I could disagree with you, because I think talk radio democratized a lot of the debate back when it first arose in the early 1990s, I think it's just become a kind of toxic barrel of sludge that is poisoning our national debate.
Let me throw something else at you. This is a little bit off the beaten track, but I'll tell you, you know, I talk to people all day long, and I get to talk to a whole wide range of people. Here's the thing that's really interesting about Trump. It doesn't matter who I speak with. Everybody has a different take on this guy, why they're supporting him, why he rose to the top. There's never just this is it. I think he's all things to all people. I think that's his trip, that he is able to somehow, he has figured out the game, the flim flam man. You know, if I talk to Susan on Tuesday, I can say what I want and make her convinced that that's what it is. But if I talk to, you know, Barbara on Friday, it's going to be a different thing because that's what Barbara wants to hear. And somehow, even in the limelight of this massive media coverage of him, he gets away with it.
Well, let's not let the media off the hook.
I'm not. I'm blaming the media because I've had the best and the brightest
Fox.
Not just Fox. I've had the best and the brightest on both sides of the aisle on my show, who big media people, and said, it's your fault. A lot of this is your fault.
Absolutely. They've given him, the other night I was driving home and I was punching buttons on my satellite radio, and I was going among the TV stations, and every single one of them, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, they were all covering a Trump rally in California. Now, this was not newsworthy. There was nothing unusual about it. They simply, Trump, you know, stood up in front of a group of people and they said, great, let's turn on the cameras and just let them roll, because they're counting on Trump to say something shocking and newsworthy, which he will almost always do because that's his medium. But you're right that people also are just, Trump is a stand-in for whatever they want to believe. If you believe that America needs a businessman, he's a businessman. If you believe that America needs you know, a fighter for, you know, white Christians, because that's a big part of that ugly undertow of his support, then he's that guy. They totally ignore any contradictory information. In a way, the Trump campaign is this huge experiment in confirmation bias. People only hear about him what they want to hear, and they totally filter out any of the other information, which is terrifying.
But I want to get back to this, and that is, I think we really do have to be careful, and I think it could be very helpful if we could figure out this phenomena. And I don't want to write it off, as we are wont to often do, either as a conservative or even if it were on the other side for Bernie, a liberal. We want to write it off as it's them, it's, you know, it's the voters, this is what they need, this is what they're seeing. I want to look at it from another point of view, because, you know, if the party elites sanction the Never Trump movement, you know what makes the party appear as elites, which is counterintuitive to what they want to accomplish, because they're playing in Trump's hands. Has he built it so that there's no way out? That's possible. He could be such a smart aleck that he, you know, he figured out every angle that was going to come at him, and he fixed it so that there would be no real hard answers. But my point is this, you know, he said at one point, conservative schmerbative. Remember when he said that line a couple of weeks ago? We've got issues that need to be taken care of. Two-pronged question. Has the establishment lost touch with the base? That's a real question, Tom, I want an answer to. And what happens to the party if it does completely alienate that base? That's a problem.
You know, I come from a working class town in Massachusetts where people like Trump are popular. And I think it's the other way around. I think the base has come to identify the Republican Party as the party of the not Democrats, which I think is an unfortunate thing, because I think that's the space Trump has run into. If you ask Trump what he's about, he tells you what he's not about. He's not about political correctness. He's not about open borders and immigration. He's not about free trade. You never hear what he's for. And I think that for a lot of people, the Republican Party became the default answer to feeling pushed out of the Democratic Party, especially the white working class. That's been going on since the 1960s and early 70s. Has the party lost touch with them? Yeah, I guess to some extent they have, because the Republican Party, especially once it reached a majority, had to concern itself with the boring daily business of governing, of actually passing bills and writing legislation. But the other thing that younger conservatives particularly really infuriate me with, they say, the GOP has lost touch with us and it hasn't done anything. Since 2009, the GOP has won at the state and federal levels over 900 seats, including 30-something governor's mansions. This is a huge sea change. This has been Sean Trend at the at Real Clear Politics wrote a piece noting that the GOP is stronger than it's been in almost 100 years because of these local wins. But because people are obsessed with this leader dynamic, with this strong man at the top idea, Trump has convinced people that the GOP represents nothing about them and hasn't managed to do anything. So if you can't win back those people, I don't know what else to say to them, because they want things that are inherently contradictory. And I'll even go a step further and say, I will dismiss the Bernie voters the same way. I think that the Bernie voters get out there and, you know, Bernie says, I'll give you free college. And they say, okay, good enough for me. That's not a real campaign. That's not the way grownups approach politics. And if the Democratic Party can't reason with Bernie's voters, I guess I have a certain amount of sympathy for them. And I am no fan of Hillary Clinton. I think everything I've written has made it clear that I think Hillary Clinton is going to be a disastrous president. I think she's one of the worst people in American politics in the modern era. But I have a certain amount of sympathy for the inability to run against a guy who stands up, says, you know, a Vermont senator who's never really had any impact on anything. And he says, I'll give you all kinds of free stuff. And people say, well, I'm for that. You can't argue with that. You can't reason with that.
Trump or Hillary, where are you going?
I've already written a piece saying that if I were forced to pick between them, I would pick Hillary. But it's not going to matter for me, because I live in a blue state that's going to go for Hillary anyway. So I'm going to vote third party and withhold my vote from both of these people, because they're both odious as far as I'm concerned. But to answer the question, honestly, if it were a national tie and I were the last electoral vote and I had to break the national tie between Trump or Clinton, I would hold my nose and I would weep and I would choose Clinton.
Wow.
Simply in part because whatever her other problems, including her utter lack of ethics and her recklessness with classified material, I really think Donald Trump is emotionally unstable. And I can't put a man like that in the White House. I just can't. I can't countenance putting somebody that I think has genuine emotional instability in the Oval Office.
Now, the journalist in me has to go there with you. You understand that. And the journalist says to me, you have any proof of that, or is it just watching his actions?
That's purely my opinion as a layperson, as a voter, as a citizen. I only represent myself here as a writer, but I think the man has a serious narcissistic problem. You ask him a question, how will you deal with China? And he says, I'm very popular. How will you deal with Russia? Ted Cruz is awful. How will you, you know, bring industrialization back to the American heartland? You know, I've won many states. He is not comfortable with any question that doesn't come back to him or himself.
My answer to you on that would be that I think that a lot of people take what he says literally. I don't ever think he means anything to be taken literally. I'm from New York. I understand Trump. I understand the generation of male that Trump comes from. He's the last of a dying breed on that, I got to tell you. I'm not excusing him, so don't think that. I'm simply saying he's like the Sinatra of politics right now. Do you know that?
I don't think that's good enough. I don't think saying, you know, he's just, I mean, I lived in New York for a while. I went to grad school there, and I still spend a lot of time in New York. And I know plenty of older men in New York who are not narcissistic ignoramuses. I'm sorry, it's not good enough.
I don't think he is an ignoramus. I'm going to argue with you on that. I think he's a smart guy. Maybe not in the way that you are or even maybe that I am, but in that guy's got some street smarts going on that are wily.
I think he's easily one of the stupidest people who's ever run for national office in the United States.
I think he's one of ill-informed people running for the president of the United States. That scares me. But that doesn't mean that he's dumb, because I don't think he's dumb at all. I would argue with you on that point. Let me get to something else, because I'm watching that clock and I really wanted to go here with you.
Sure.
Talk to me about this. The notions of the times are a-changing, and conservatism. I can't tell you how many people say to me, they don't get it. They're locked in to conservative values when the rest of the world is moving on. Talk to me about time-honored values, conservatism, and Trump, because I know that's part of what your argument is, why you can't handle this guy.
I think, again, that is camouflage behind which resentful voters who are experiencing a lot of relative deprivation, I call it the Facebook envy or the HGTV effect problem. I think that's a smokescreen they hide behind, because if you look at Trump supporters, the way they interact with the media, the way they interact with social media, the way they behave at rallies, these are people who have no compunction about using homophobic slurs, racial slurs, you know, every kind of coarseness and vulgarity. So this notion that somehow, well, this is just because conservatives like me can't handle them. I would argue in some ways, I'm certainly more, how would I put this, that Trump supporters are a throwback to conservatism the way it was, you know, pre-Archie Bunker, that in some ways they're the conservatives, or they think they are the conservatives, when in fact they are just ignorant and racist and angry about the conditions of their lives. I mean, I am very reluctant to give an inch here that any of this is about values or policies. I think these are people that are just mad about their lives and they want somebody to blame. But the conservatives like me who have been opposing Trump, the one thing I will caution about is that if Trump becomes the head of the only conservative major party, I mean, the libertarians will take issue with me about that, but the major party that's the vehicle for conservative ideas, he will destroy it. He will burn it to the ground along with all of its ideas, because in his bones, insofar as Trump believes in anything, he's basically a big government crony capitalist liberal, and he's hiding behind taking shots at Mexicans and Muslims and everybody else. And I think there's going to be a huge buyer's remorse about this. First, I think Hillary Clinton's election is practically assured by this. But I think even before then, a lot of people are going to wake up with a hangover and wonder what they were thinking, because a lot of these positions are really just shameful positions in either party. Some of this just goes beyond the basics of human decency, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
You could also say standing on principle, not changing with the times, which I mentioned a moment ago, thwarting the will of the people, ideology over compromise. What's the old saying? I was thinking about this morning, and there are many variations on it. Trees that don't bend with the wind won't last the storm. Is it all right with you to blow up the Republican Party? Because that could happen.
I was a Republican for 33 years. I left briefly during the 2012 primary when I got fed up with watching people like Newt Gingrich winning primaries. No, it's not okay with me if they blow up the Republican Party. America needs a conservative party. The Democrats need to be given a fair fight at the White House level. And Trump is hijacking that party with a lot of voters, by the way, who have crossed over merely to interfere in a Republican primary. I think one thing you'll see in 2020 is the elimination of a lot of open primaries in a lot of states. So no, it's not okay with me, because I think parties ought to be about ideas, and Trump is about Trump. He's not about ideas. He's about himself.
But you realize that if the no Trump either win or it goes to convention and he's got all those votes and then he doesn't get it, that it will blow up the party.
If that is the price of being part of the Never Trump movement, then I would rather see the party blow up on principle than have it knuckle under to Trump merely for the sake of trying to beat Hillary Clinton for 4 years. I think one thing that will happen if Trump gains control of the party is that the down ballot losses and the reverberations through the rest of the Republican Party and the conservative movement, which is more important to me than the party, will be catastrophic. So it's kind of like I said in my piece about friendships. If that's what it comes to, so be it.
One last question. Let's lighten it up as we close. Ready?
Sure.
What is Alex Trebek really like?
You know, it's a funny thing about Jeopardy. I can be introduced to a crowd of people and they'll say, you know, he's a former Senate aide, he has a doctorate, he taught at, you know, all these universities, and people nod politely. And then you say, and he was on Jeopardy, and everybody starts to clap because it's, you know, the real badge of achievement in American society.
Well, it gives you got a brain full of a lot of information, buddy. I love it.
useless information unless you're on Jeopardy.
I don't know. Got you 50 grand or something, right?
Yeah, I did. I want a solid amount of money. You know, I can't really tell you what Alex Trebek is like. Off camera, he's kind of standoffish. I mean, we sort of shake hands on camera, and then he sort of disappears and does his own thing. He's not the most social guy in the world. Yeah. I'll say that. But he makes all the contestants feel welcome while they're on the air, and that's really all that matters. But, you know, we don't exchange Christmas cards or anything like that.
I've been speaking with Tom Nichols. Discover his work at thefederalist.com and follow Tom on Twitter at Radio Free Tom. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieCancerJane.com.